across the compound. It was then, Rat said, that he picked out Marianne's face. Her eyes seemed to shine in the dark. Not blue, though, but a bright, glowing jungle green. She did not pause at Fosse's bunker. She cradled her weapon and moved swiftly to the Special Forces hooch and followed the others inside. Briefly a light came on, and someone laughed. Then the place went dark again. Whenever he told the story, Rat had a tendency to stop now and then, interrupting the flow, inserting little clarifications or bits of analysis and personal opinion. It was a bad habit, Mitchell Sanders said, because all that matters is the raw material, the stuff itself, and you can't clutter it up with your own half-baked commentary. It just breaks the spell. It destroys the magic. What you have to do, Sanders says, is trust your own story, get the hell out of the way, and let it tell itself. But Rat Kiley couldn't help it. He wanted to bracket the full range of meaning. I know it sounds far out, he tell us, but it's not like impossible or anything. We all heard plenty of wackier stories. Some guy comes back from the bush, tells you he saw the Virgin Mary out there, she was riding a goddamn goose or something. Everybody buys it. Everybody smiles and asks, how fast was they going? Did she have spurs on? Well, it's not like that. This Marianne wasn't no virgin, but at least she was real. I saw it. When she came through the wire that night, I was right there. I saw those eyes of hers. I saw how she wasn't even the same person no more. What's so impossible about that? She was a girl, that's all. I mean, if it was a guy, everybody'd say, hey, no big deal. He got caught up in the nom shit. He got seduced by the greenies. See what I mean? You got these blinders on about women, how gentle and peaceful they are, all that crap about if we had a pussy for president, there wouldn't be no more wars. Pure garbage. You got to get rid of that sexist attitude. Rat would go on like that until Mitchell Sanders couldn't tolerate it any longer. It offended his inner ear. The story. Sanders would say. The whole tone, man, you're wrecking it. Tone? The sound. You need to get a consistent sound, like slow or fast or funny or sad. All these digressions, they just screw up your story sound. Stick to what happened. Frowning, Rat would close his eyes. Tone? He'd say. I didn't know it was all that complicated. The girl joined the zoo. One more animal. End of story. Yeah, fine. But tell it right. At daybreak the next morning, when Mark Fosse heard she was back, he stationed himself outside the fenced-off Special Forces area. All morning he waited for her, and all afternoon. Around dusk, Rat brought him something to eat. She has to come out, Fosse said. Sooner or later, she has to. Or else what? Rat said. I'd go get her. I'd bring her out. Rat shook his head. Your decision. I was you, though, no way I'd mess around with any greenie types, not for nothing. It's Marianne in there. Sure, I know that. All the same, I'd knock real extra super polite. Even with the cooling night air, Fosse's face was slick with sweat. He looked sick. His eyes were bloodshot. His skin had a whitish, almost colorless cast. For a few minutes, Rat waited with him, quietly watching the hooch. Then he patted the kid's shoulder and left him alone. It was after midnight when Rat and Eddie Diamond went out to check on him. The night had gone cold and steamy, a low fog sliding down from the mountains, and out in the dark there was music playing, not loud, but not soft either. It had a chaotic, almost unmusical sound, without rhythm or form or progression, like the noise of nature, a synthesizer, it seemed, or maybe an electric organ. In the background, just audible, a woman's voice was half-singing, half-chanting, but the lyrics seemed to be in a foreign tongue. They found Fosse squatting near the gate in front of the Special Forces area. Head bowed, he was swaying to the music, his face wet and shiny. As Eddie bent down beside him, the kid looked up with eyes not quite in register, ashen and powdery. "Hear that?" he whispered. "You hear? It's Marianne." Eddie Diamond took his arm. "Let's get you inside. Somebody's radio, that's all it is. Move it now. Marianne, just listen. Sure, but listen. Fossey suddenly pulled away, twisting sideways, and fell back against the gate. He lay there with his eyes closed. The music, the noise, whatever it was, came from the hooch beyond the fence. The place was dark, except for a small glowing window, which stood partly open, the panes dancing in bright reds and yellows, as though the glass were on fire. The chanting seemed louder now, fiercer, too, and higher pitched. Fossey pushed himself up. He wavered for a moment, and then forced the gate open. "That voice," he said. "Marianne." Rat took a step forward, reaching out for him, but Fossey was already moving fast toward the hooch. He stumbled once, caught himself, then struck the door hard with both arms. There was a noise, a short, screeching sound like a cat, and the door swung in and Fossey was framed there for an instant, his arms stretched out, and then he slipped inside. After a moment, Rat and Eddie followed quietly. Just inside the door, they found Fossey bent down on one knee. He wasn't moving. Across the room, a dozen candles were burning on the floor near the open window. The place seemed to echo with a deep wilderness sound, tribal music, bamboo flutes and drums and chimes, but what hit you first, Rat said, was the smell. Two kinds of smells. There was the topmost scent of joss sticks and incense, like the fumes of some exotic smokehouse, but beneath the smoke lay a deeper and much more powerful stench. Impossible to describe, Rat said. It paralyzed your lungs, thick and numbing like an animal's den, a mix of blood and scorched hair and excrement and the sweet-sour odor of moldering flesh, the stink of the kill. But that wasn't all. On a post at the rear of the hooch was a decayed head of a large black leopard. Stripes of yellow-brown skin dangled from the overhead rafters, and bones. Stacks of bones, all kinds. To one side, propped up against a wall, stood a poster in neat black lettering. Assemble your own gook. Free sample kit. The images came in a swirl, Rat said, and there was no way you could process it all. Off in the gloom, a few dim figures lounged in hammocks or on cots, but none of them moved or spoke. The background music came from a tape deck near the circle of candles, but the high voice was Marianne's. Mark Fossey started to get up, but then stiffened. "Marianne?" he said. Quietly, then, she stepped out of the shadows. At least for a moment she seemed to be the same pretty young girl who had arrived a few weeks earlier. She was barefoot. She wore her pink sweater with a white blouse and a simple black cotton skirt. For a long while the girl gazed down at Fossey, almost blankly. And in the candlelight, her face had the composure of someone perfectly at peace with herself. It took a few seconds, Rat said, to appreciate the full change. In part, it was her eyes, utterly flat and indifferent. There was no emotion in her stare, no sense of the person behind it. But the grotesque part, he said, was her jewelry. At the girl's throat was a necklace of human tongues, elongated and narrow, like pieces of blackened leather. The tongues were threaded along the length of a copper wire, one tongue overlapping the next. The tips curled upward as if caught in a final shrill syllable. Just for a moment, the girl looked at Mark Fossey with something close to contempt. "There's no sense in talking," she said. "I know what you think, but it's not bad." "Bad?" Fossey murmured. "It's not." In the shadows, there was laughter. One of the greenies sat up and lighted a cigar. The others lay silent. "You're in a place," Marianne said softly, "where you don't belong." She moved her hand in a gesture that encompassed not just the hooch, but everything around it, the entire war, the mountains, the mean little villages, the trails and trees and rivers and deep, misted-over valleys. "You just don't know," she said. "You hide in this little fortress, behind wire and sandbags, and you don't know. Sometimes I want to eat this place, the whole country, the dirt, the death. I just want to swallow it and have it there inside me. That's how I feel. It's like this appetite, I get scared sometimes, lots of times, but it's not bad, you know? I feel close to myself. When I'm out there at night, I feel close to my own body. I can feel my blood moving, my skin, and my fingernails, everything. It's like I'm full of electricity, and I'm glowing in the dark. I'm on fire, almost. I'm burning away into nothing. But it doesn't matter, because I know exactly who I am. You can't feel like that anywhere else. All of this was said without drama, as if to herself, her voice slow and impassive. She was not trying to persuade. For a few moments she looked at Mark Fossey, who seemed to shrink away. Then she turned and moved back into the gloom. There was nothing to be done. Rat took Fossey's arm, helped him up, and led him outside. In the darkness there was that flipped-out tribal music, which seemed to come from the earth itself, from the deep rainforest, and a woman's voice rising up in a language beyond translation. Mark Fossey stood rigid. "Do something," he whispered. "I can't just let her go like that." Rat listened for a time, then shook his head. "Man, you must be deaf. She's already gone." Rat Kiley stopped there, almost in mid-sentence, which drove Mitchell Sanders crazy. "What next?" he said.
"Next?
The girl. What happened to her?" Rat made a small, tired motion with his shoulders. "Hard to tell for sure. 3-4 days later, I got orders to report here to Alpha Company. Jumped the first chopper out. That's the last I ever seen of the place. Marianne, too." Mitchell Sanders stared at him.
"You can't do that."
"Do what?"
"Jesus Christ, it's against the rules," Sanders said. "Against human nature. This elaborate story, you can't say, 'Hey, by the way, I don't know the ending.' I mean, you got certain obligations."
Rat gave a quick smile.
"Okay, man, but up until now, everything I told you is from personal experience, the exact truth. There's a few other things I heard secondhand. Third hand, actually. From here on, it gets to be, I don't know what the word is,
speculation."
"Yeah, right."
Rat looked off to the west, scanning the mountains, as if expecting something to appear on one of the high ridgelines. After a second, he shrugged. "Anyhow, maybe 2 months later I ran into Eddie Diamond over in Bangkok. I was on R&R, just this fluke thing. And he told me some stuff I can't vouch for with my own eyes. Even Eddie didn't really see it. He heard it from one of the greenies. So you can take this with a whole shaker full of salt." Once more, Rat searched the mountains. Then he sat back and closed his eyes.
"You know," he said abruptly, "I loved her."
"Say again?"
"A lot. We all did, I guess. The way she looked, Marianne, made you think about all those girls back home. How pure and innocent they all are. How they'll never understand any of this, not in a billion years. Try and tell them about it, they'll just stare at you with those big round candy eyes. They won't understand zip. It's like trying to tell somebody what chocolate tastes like."
Mitchell Sanders nodded.
"Oh, shit. There it is. You gotta taste it. And that's the thing with Marianne. She was there. She was up to her eyeballs in it. After the war, man, I promise you, you won't find nobody like her."
Suddenly, Rat pushed up to his feet, moved a few steps away from us, then stopped and stood with his back turned. He was an emotional guy.
"Got hooked, I guess," he said. "I loved her. So when I heard from Eddie about what happened, it almost made me, like you say, it's pure speculation."
"Go on," Mitchell Sanders said. "Finish up." "What happened to her," Rat said, "was what happened to all of them. You come over clean, and you get dirty, and then afterward it's never the same. A question of degree. Some make it intact, some don't make it at all. For Marianne Bell, it seemed, Vietnam had the effect of a powerful drug, that mix of unnamed terror and unnamed pleasure that comes as the needle slips in and you know you're risking something. The endorphins start to flow and the adrenaline, and you hold your breath and creep quietly through the moonlit nightscapes. You become intimate with danger. You're in touch with the far side of yourself, as though it's another hemisphere. And you want to string it out and go wherever the trip takes you, and be host to all the possibilities inside yourself.
Not bad, she'd said.
Vietnam made her glow in the dark. She wanted more. She wanted to penetrate deeper into the mystery of herself. And after time, the wanting became needing, which turned then to craving. According to Eddie Diamond, who heard it from one of the greenies, she took a greedy pleasure in night patrols. She was good at it. She had the moves, all camouflaged up, her face smooth and vacant. She seemed to flow like water through the dark, like oil, without sound or center. She went barefoot. She stopped carrying a weapon. There were times, apparently, when she took crazy death wish chances, things that even the greenies balked at. It was as if she were taunting some wild creature out in the bush or in her head, inviting it to show itself, a curious game of hide-and-go-seek that was played out in the dense terrain of a nightmare. She was lost inside herself. On occasion, when they were taken under fire, Marianne would stand quietly and watch the tracer rounds snap by, a little smile at her lips, intent on some private transaction with the war. Other times she would simply vanish altogether, for hours, for days. And then one morning, all alone, Marianne walked off into the mountains and did not come back. No body was ever found, no equipment, no clothing. For all he knew, Rat said, the girl was still alive. Maybe up in one of the high mountain villes, maybe with the Montagnard tribes, but that was guesswork. There was an inquiry, of course, and a week-long air search, and for a time the Trabong compound went crazy with MP and CID types. In the end, however, nothing came of it. It was a war, and the war went on. Mark Fossey was busted to PFC, shipped back to a hospital in the States, and 2 months later received a medical discharge. Marianne Bell joined the missing. But the story did not end there. If you believe the greenies, Rat said, Marianne was still somewhere out there, in the dark. Odd movements, odd shapes. Late at night, when the greenies were out on ambush, the whole rainforest seemed to stare in at them. A watched feeling. And a couple of times they almost saw her sliding through the shadows. Not quite, but almost. She had crossed to the other side. She was part of the land. She was wearing her culottes, her pink sweater, and a necklace of human tongues. She was dangerous. She was ready for the kill. Stockings. Henry Dobbins was a good man and a superb soldier, but sophistication was not his strong suit. The ironies went beyond him. In many ways, he was like America itself. Big and strong, full of good intentions, a roll of fat jiggling at his belly, slow of foot but always plodding along, always there when you needed him, a believer in the virtues of simplicity and directness and hard labor. Like his country, too, Dobbins was drawn toward sentimentality. Even now, 20 years later, I could see him wrapping his girlfriend's pantyhose around his neck before heading out on ambush. It was his one eccentricity. The pantyhose, he said, had the properties of a good luck charm. He liked putting his nose into the nylon and breathing in the scent of his girlfriend's body. He liked the memories this inspired. He sometimes slept with the stockings up against his face, the way an infant sleeps with a flannel blanket, secure and peaceful. More than anything, though, the stockings were a talisman for him. They kept him safe. They gave him access to a spiritual world, where things were soft and intimate, a place where he might someday take his girlfriend to live. Like many of us in Vietnam, Dobbins felt the pull of superstition, and he believed firmly and absolutely in the protective power of the stockings. They were like body armor, he thought. Whenever we saddled up for a late-night ambush, putting on our helmets and flak jackets, Henry Dobbins would make a ritual out of arranging the nylons around his neck, carefully tying a knot, draping the two leg sections over his left shoulder. There were some jokes, of course, but we came to appreciate the mystery of it all. Dobbins was invulnerable, never wounded, never a scratch. In August, he tripped a bouncing Betty, which failed to detonate, and a week later he got caught in the open during a fierce little firefight, no cover at all, but he just slipped the pantyhose over his nose and breathed deep and let the magic do its work. It turned us into a platoon of believers. You don't dispute facts. But then, near the end of October, his girlfriend dumped him. It was a hard blow. Dobbins went quiet for a while, staring down at her letter. Then after a time, he took out the stockings and tied them around his neck as a comforter. "No sweat," he said. "The magic doesn't go away." Church. One afternoon, somewhere west of the Bantanggang Peninsula, we came across an abandoned pagoda. Or almost abandoned, because a pair of monks lived there in a tar-paper shack, tending a small garden and some broken shrines. They spoke almost no English at all. When we dug our foxholes in the yard, the monks did not seem upset or displeased, though the younger one performed a washing motion with his hands. No one could decide what it meant. The older monk led us into the pagoda. The place was dark and cool, I remember, with crumbling walls and sandbagged windows, and a ceiling full of holes. "It's bad news," Kiowa said. "You don't mess with churches." But we spent the night there, turning the pagoda into a little fortress, and then for the next 7 or 8 days, we used the place as a base of operations. It was mostly a very peaceful time. Each morning, the two monks brought us buckets of water. They giggled when we stripped down to bathe. They smiled happily when we soaped up and splashed one another. On the second day, the older monk carried in a cane chair for the use of Lieutenant Jimmy Cross, placing it near the altar area, bowing and gesturing for him to sit down. The old monk seemed proud of the chair, and proud that such a man as Lieutenant Cross should be sitting in it. On another occasion, the younger monk presented us with 4 ripe watermelons from his garden. He stood watching until the watermelons were eaten down to the rinds. Then he smiled and made the strange washing motion with his hands. Though they were kind to all of us, the monks took a special liking for Henry Dobbins.
"Soldier Jesus," they'd say. "Good soldier Jesus."
Squatting quietly in the cool pagoda, they would help Dobbins disassemble and clean his machine gun, carefully brushing the parts with oil. The 3 of them seemed to have an understanding, nothing in words, just a quietness they shared. "You know," Dobbins said to Kiowa one morning, "after the war, maybe I'll join up with these guys."
"Join how?" Kiowa said.
"Wear robes, take the pledge." Kiowa thought about it.
"That's a new one. I didn't know you were all that religious."
"Well, I'm not," Dobbins said. Beside him, the 2 monks were working on the M60. He watched them take turns running oiled swabs through the barrel.
"I mean, I'm not the churchy type. When I was a little kid way back, I used to sit there on Sunday counting bricks in the wall. Church wasn't for me. But then in high school, I started to think about how I'd like to be a minister. Free house, free car, lots of potlucks. Looked like a pretty good life."
"You're serious?" Kiowa said. Dobbins shrugged his shoulders.
"What's serious? I was a kid. The thing is, I believed in God and all that, but it wasn't the religious part that interested me. Just being nice to people, that's all, being decent."
"Right," Kiowa said.
"Visit sick people, stuff like that. I would have been good at it, too. Not the brainy part, not sermons and all that, but I'd be okay with the people part."
Henry Dobbins was silent for a time. He smiled at the older monk who was now cleaning the machine gun's trigger assembly.
"But anyway," Dobbins said, "I could never be a real minister, because you'd have to be super sharp. Upstairs, I mean. It takes brains. You'd have to explain some hard stuff, like why people die or why God invented pneumonia and all that."
He shook his head. I just don't have the smarts for it, and there's the religious thing, too. All these years, man, I still hate church."
"Maybe you'd change," Kiowa said.
Henry Dobbins closed his eyes briefly, then laughed.
"One thing for sure, I'd look spiffy in those robes they wear, just like Friar Tuck. Maybe I'll do it. Find a monastery somewhere, wear a robe, and be nice to people."
"Sounds good," Kiowa said. The two monks were quiet as they cleaned and oiled the machine gun. Though they spoke almost no English, they seemed to have a great respect for the conversation, as if sensing that important matters were being discussed. The younger monk used a yellow cloth to wipe dirt from a belt of ammunition.
"What about you?" Davin said.
"How?"
"Well, you carry that Bible everywhere. You never hardly swear or anything. You must..."
"I grew up that way," Kiowa said.
"Well, did you ever, you know, think about being a minister?"
"No, not ever."
Davin's laughed. "An Indian preacher, man, that's one I'd love to see. Feathers and buffalo robes." Kiowa lay on his back, looking up at the ceiling, and for a time he didn't speak. Then he sat up and took a drink from his canteen.
"Not a minister," he said, "but I do like churches. The way it feels inside. It feels good when you just sit there like you're a forest and everything's really quiet. Except there's still this sound you can't hear."
"Yeah. You ever feel that?"
"Sort of."
Kiowa made a noise in his throat.
"This is all wrong," he said.
"What?"
"Setting up here, it's wrong. I don't care what, it's still a church."
Davin's nodded.
"True."
"A church," Kiowa said. "Just wrong."
When the two monks finished cleaning the machine gun, Henry Davin's began reassembling it, wiping off the excess oil. Then he handed each of them a can of peaches and a chocolate bar.
"Okay," he said. "Deedy mao, boys. Beat it."
The monks bowed and moved out of the pagoda into the bright morning sunlight. Henry Davin's made the washing motion with his hands.
"You're right," he said. "All you can do is be nice. Treat them decent, you know."
The man I killed. His jaw was in his throat. His upper lip and teeth were gone. His one eye was shut. His other eye was a star-shaped hole. His eyebrows were thin and arched like a woman's. His nose was undamaged. There was a slight tear in the lobe of one ear. His clean black hair was swept upward into a cowlick at the rear of his skull. His forehead was lightly freckled. His fingernails were clean. The skin at his left cheek was peeled back in three ragged strips. His right cheek was smooth and hairless. There was a butterfly on his chin. His neck was open to the spinal cord, and the blood there was thick and shiny. And it was the wound that killed him. He lay face up in the center of the trail, a slim, dead, almost dainty young man. He had bony legs, a narrow waist, long, shapely fingers. His chest was sunken and poorly muscled, a scholar, maybe. His wrists were the wrists of a child. He wore a black shirt, black pajama pants, a gray ammunition belt, a gold ring on the third finger of his right hand. His rubber sandals had been blown off. One lay beside him, the other a few meters up the trail. He had been born, maybe, in 1946 in the village of Mi-Ke near the central coastline of Quang-Gai province, where his parents farmed and where his family have lived for several centuries, and where, during the time of the French, his father and two uncles and many neighbors had joined in the struggle for independence. He was not a communist. He was a citizen and a soldier. In the village of Mi-Ke, as in all of Quang-Gai, patriotic resistance had the force of tradition, which was partly the force of legend, and from his earliest boyhood, the man I killed would have listened to stories about the heroic Trung sisters and Drong Hung Dao's famous rout of the Mongols and Lei Loi's final victory against the Chinese at Tat Dong. He would have been taught that to defend the land was a man's highest duty and highest privilege. He had accepted this. It was never open to question. Secretly, though, it also frightened him. He was not a fighter. His health was poor, his body small and frail. He liked books. He wanted someday to be a teacher of mathematics. At night, lying on his mat, he could not picture himself doing the brave things his father had done, or his uncles, or the heroes of the stories. He hoped in his heart that he would never be tested. He hoped the Americans would go away. Soon, he hoped. He kept hoping and hoping, always, even when he was asleep.
"Oh, man, you fucking trashed that fucker," Azar said. "You scrambled his sorry self. Look at that. You did. You laid him out like a shredded fucking wheat."
"Go away," Kiowa said.
"I'm just saying the truth, like oatmeal."
"Go," Kiowa said.
"Okay, then I take it back,"
Azar said. He started to move away, then stopped and said,
"Rice Krispies, you know? On the dead test, this particular individual gets A+.
Smiling at this, he shrugged and walked up the trail toward the village behind the trees. Kiowa kneeled down. "Just forget that crud," he said. He opened up his canteen and held it out for a while, and then sighed and pulled it away. "No sweat, man. What else could you do?" Later, Kiowa said, "I'm serious. Nothing anybody could do. Come on, stop staring." The trail junction was shaded by a row of trees and tall brush. The slim young man lay with his legs in the shade. His jaw was in his throat. His one eye was shut and the other was a star-shaped hole. Kiowa glanced at the body.
"All right, let me ask a question," he said. "You want to trade places with him? Turn it all upside down. You want that? I mean, be honest."
The star-shaped hole was red and yellow. The yellow part seemed to be getting whiter, spreading out at the center of the star. The upper lip and gum and teeth were gone. The man's head was cocked at a wrong angle, as if loose at the neck, and the neck was wet with blood.
"Think it over," Kiowa said. And later he said, "Tim, it's war. The guy wasn't Heidi. He had a weapon, right? It's a tough thing for sure, but you gotta cut out that staring." And then he said, "Maybe you better lie down a minute."
Then, after a long empty time, he said, "Take it slow. Just go wherever the spirit takes you." The butterfly was making its way along the young man's forehead, which was spotted with small dark freckles. The nose was undamaged. The skin on the right cheek was smooth and fine-grained and hairless, frail-looking, delicately boned. The young man would not have wanted to be a soldier, and in his heart would have feared performing badly in battle. Even as a boy growing up in the village of Mi Kay, he had often worried about this. He imagined covering his head and lying in a deep hole, and closing his eyes and not moving until the war was over. He had no stomach for violence. He loved mathematics. His eyebrows were thin and arched like a woman's, and at school the boy sometimes teased him about how pretty he was, the arched eyebrows and the long, shapely fingers. And on the playground they mimicked a woman's walk and made fun of his smooth skin and his love for mathematics. The young man could not make himself fight them. He often wanted to, but he was afraid, and this increased his shame. If he could not fight little boys, he thought, how could he ever become a soldier and fight the Americans with their airplanes and helicopters and bombs? It did not seem possible. In the presence of his father and uncles, he pretended to look forward to doing his patriotic duty, which was also a privilege. But at night, he prayed with his mother that the war might end soon. Beyond anything else, he was afraid of disgracing himself and therefore his family and village. But all he could do, he thought, was to wait and pray and try not to grow up too fast.
"Listen to me," Kiowa said. "You feel terrible, I know that." Then he said, "Okay, maybe I don't know."
Along the trail there were small blue flowers shaped like bells. The young man's head was wrenched sideways, not quite facing the flowers, and even in the shade, a single blade of sunlight sparkled against the buckle of his ammunition belt. The left cheek was peeled back in three ragged strips. The wounds at his neck had not yet clotted, which made him seem adamant, even in death, the blood still spreading out across his shirt. Kiowa shook his head. There was some silence before he said, "Stop staring." The young man's fingernails were clean. There was a slight tear at the lobe of one ear, a sprinkling of blood on the forearm. He wore a gold ring on the third finger of his right hand. His chest was sunken and poorly muscled, a scholar, maybe. His life was now a constellation of possibilities. So yes, maybe a scholar. And for years, despite his family's poverty, the man I killed would have been determined to continue his education in mathematics. The means for this were arranged, perhaps through the village liberation cadres, and in 1964 the young man began attending classes at the university in Saigon, where he avoided politics and paid attention to the problems of calculus. He devoted himself to his studies. He spent his nights alone, wrote romantic poems in his journal, took pleasure in the grace and beauty of differential equations. The war, he knew, would finally take him. But for the time being, he would not let himself think about it. He had stopped praying. Instead, now, he waited. And as he waited, in his final year at the university, he fell in love with a classmate, a girl of 17, who one day told him that his wrists were like the wrists of a child, so small and delicate, and who admired his narrow waist and the cowlick that rose up like a bird's tail at the back of his head. She liked his quiet manner. She laughed at his freckles and bony legs. One evening, perhaps, they exchanged gold rings. Now, One Eye was a star.
"You okay?" Kaiwa said.
The corpse lay almost entirely in shade. There were gnats at the mouth, little flecks of pollen drifting above the nose. The butterfly was gone. The bleeding had stopped except for the neck wounds. Kaiwa picked up the rubber sandals, clapping off the dirt, then bent down to search the body. He found a pouch of rice, a comb, a fingernail clipper, a few soiled piastres, a snapshot of a young woman standing in front of a parked motorcycle. Kaiwa placed these items in his rucksack along with the gray ammunition belt and rubber sandals. Then he squatted down.
"I'll tell you the straight truth," he said. "The guy was dead the second he stepped on the trail. Understand me? We all had him zeroed. A good kill. Weapon, ammunition, everything."
Tiny beads of sweat glistened at Kaiwa's forehead. His eyes moved from the sky to the dead man's body to the knuckles on his own hands.
"So listen. You best pull your shit together. You just can't sit here all day."
Later he said, "Understand?" Then he said, "5 minutes, Tim. 5 more minutes and we're moving out." Then One Eye did a funny, twinkling trick, red to yellow. His head was wrenched sideways, as if loose at the neck, and the dead young man seemed to be staring at some distant object beyond the bell-shaped flowers along the trail. The blood at the neck had gone to a deep purplish black. Clean fingernails, clean hair. He'd been a soldier for only a single day. After his years at the university, the man I killed returned with his new wife to the village of Mekay, where he enlisted as a common rifleman with the 48th Viet Cong Battalion. He knew he would die quickly. He knew he would see a flash of light. He knew he would fall dead and wake up in the stories of his village and people. Kaiwa covered the body with a poncho.
"Hey, you're looking better," he said. "No doubt about it. All you needed was time. Some mental R&R.
Then he said, "Man, I'm sorry." Then later he said, "Why not talk about it?" Then he said, "Come on, man, talk." He was a slim, dead, almost dainty young man of about 20. He lay with one leg bent beneath him, his jaw on his throat, his face neither expressive nor inexpressive. One eye was shut. The other was a star-shaped hole.
"Talk," Kaiwa said.
Ambush. When she was 9, my daughter Kathleen asked if I had ever killed anyone. She knew about the war. She knew I'd been a soldier.
"You keep writing these war stories," she said. "So I guess you must have killed somebody."
It was a difficult moment, but I did what seemed right, which was to say, "Of course not," and then to take her into my lap and hold her for a while. Someday I hope she'll ask again, but here I want to pretend she's a grown-up. I want to tell her exactly what happened, or what I remember happening. And then I want to say to her that, as a little girl, she was absolutely right. This is why I keep writing war stories. He was a short, slender young man of about 20. I was afraid of him, afraid of something. And as he passed me on the trail, I threw a grenade that exploded at his feet and killed him. Or to go back. Shortly after midnight, we moved into the ambush site outside Mikkei. The whole platoon was there, spread out in the dense brush along the trail, and for 5 hours nothing at all happened. We were working in two-man teams, one man on guard while the other slept, switching off every 2 hours. And I remember it was still dark when Kiowa shook me awake for the final watch. The night was foggy and hot. For the first few moments I felt lost, not sure about directions, groping for my helmet and weapon. I reached out and found three grenades and lined them up in front of me. The pins had already been straightened for quick throwing. And then, maybe for a half an hour, I kneeled there and waited. Very gradually, in tiny slivers, dawn began to break through the fog, and from my position in the brush, I could see 10 or 15 meters up the trail. The mosquitoes were fierce. I remember slapping at them, wondering if I should wake up Kiowa and ask for some repellent, and thinking it was a bad idea. Then looking up and seeing the young man coming out of the fog. He wore black clothing and rubber sandals, and a gray ammunition belt. His shoulders were slightly stooped, his head cocked to the side, as if listening for something. He seemed at ease. He carried his weapon in one hand, muzzle down, moving without any hurry up the center of the trail. There was no sound at all, none that I can remember. In a way, it seemed he was part of the morning fog, or my own imagination. But there was also the reality of what was happening in my stomach. I had already pulled the pin on a grenade. I had come up to a crouch. It was entirely automatic. I did not hate the young man. I did not see him as the enemy. I did not ponder issues of morality or politics or military duty. I crouched and kept my head low. I tried to swallow whatever was rising from my stomach, which tasted like lemonade, something fruity and sour. I was terrified. There were no thoughts about killing. The grenade was to make him go away, just evaporate. And I leaned back and felt my head go empty, and then felt it fill up again. I had already thrown the grenade before telling myself to throw it. The brush was thick, and I had to lob it high, not aiming. And I remember the grenade seeming to freeze above me for an instant, as if a camera had clicked. And I remember ducking down and holding my breath and seeing little wisps of fog rise from the earth. The grenade bounced once and rolled across the trail. I did not hear it, but there must have been a sound because the young man dropped his weapon and began to run. Just two or three quick steps. Then he hesitated, swiveling to his right, and he glanced down at the grenade and tried to cover his head, but never did. It occurred to me then that he was about to die. I wanted to warn him. The grenade made a popping noise, not soft, but not loud either, not what I expected. And there was a puff of dust and smoke, a small white puff, and the man seemed to jerk upward, as if pulled by invisible wires. He fell on his back. His rubber sandals had been blown off. He lay at the center of the trail, his right leg bent beneath him, his one eye shut, his other eye a huge star-shaped hole. For me, it was not a matter of live or die. I was in no real peril. Almost certainly the young man would have passed me by, and it will always be that way. Later, I remember Kiowa tried to tell me that the young man would have died anyway. He told me that it was a good kill, that I was a soldier and this was a war, and that I should shape up and stop staring and ask myself what the dead man would have done if things were reversed. None of that mattered. The words seemed far too complicated. All I could do was gape at the fact of the young man's body. Even now, I haven't finished sorting it out. Sometimes I forgive myself, other times I don't. In the ordinary hours of life, I try not to dwell on it. But now and then, when I'm reading a newspaper or just sitting alone in a room,
I'll look up and see the young man step out of the morning fog. I'll watch him walk toward me, his shoulders slightly stooped, his head cocked to the side, and he'll pass within a few yards of me and suddenly smile at some secret thought, and then continue up the trail to where it bends back into the fog. Style. There was no music. Most of the hamlet had burned down, including her house, which was now smoke, and the girl danced with her eyes half closed, her feet bare. She was maybe 14. She had black hair and brown skin.
"Why's she dancing?" Azar said.
We searched through the wreckage, but there wasn't much to find. Rat Kylie caught a chicken for dinner. Lieutenant Cross radioed up to the gunships and told them to go away. The girl danced, mostly on her toes. She took tiny steps in the dirt in front of her house, sometimes making a slow twirl, sometimes smiling to herself.
"Why's she dancing?" Azar said.
And Henry Dobbin said it didn't matter why. She just was. Later, we found her family in the house. They were dead and badly burned. It wasn't a big family, an infant and an old woman, and a woman whose age was hard to tell. When we dragged them out, the girl kept dancing. She put the palms of her hands against her ears, which must have meant something, and she danced sideways for a short while, and then backwards. She did a graceful movement with her hips.
"Well, I don't get it," Azar said.
The smoke from the hooches smelled like straw. It moved in patches across the village square. Not thick anymore, sometimes just faint ripples like fog. There were dead pigs, too. The girl went up on her toes and made a slow turn and danced through the smoke. Her face had a dreamy look, quiet and composed. A while later, when we moved out of the hamlet, she was still dancing.
"Probably some weird ritual," Azar said.
But Henry Dobbins looked back and said no, the girl just liked to dance. That night, after we marched away from the smoking village, Azar mocked the girl's dancing. He did funny jumps and spins. He put the palm of his hands against his ears and danced sideways for a while, and then backwards. And then he did an erotic thing with his hips. But Henry Dobbins, who moved gracefully for such a big man, took Azar from behind and lifted him up high and carried him over to a deep well and asked him if he wanted to be dumped in. Azar said no.
"All right, then," Henry Dobbins said. "Dance right."
Speaking of courage. The war was over, and there was no place in particular to go. Norman Bowker followed the tar road on its 7-mile loop around the lake. Then he started all over again, driving slowly, feeling safe inside his father's big Chevy, now and then looking out on the lake to watch the boats and water skiers and scenery. It was Sunday, and it was summer, and the town seemed pretty much the same. The lake lay flat and silvery against the sun. Along the road, the houses were all low-slung and split-level and modern, with big porches and picture windows facing the water. The lawns were spacious. On the lakeside of the road, where the real estate was most valuable, the houses were handsome and set deep in, well-kept and brightly painted, with docks jutting out into the lake, and boats moored and covered with canvas, and neat gardens, and sometimes even gardeners, and stone patios with barbecue spits and grills, and wooden shingles saying who lived there. On the other side of the road, to his left, the houses were also handsome, though less expensive, and on a smaller scale, and with no docks or boats or gardeners. The road was a sort of boundary between the affluent and the almost affluent, and to live on the lakeside of the road was one of the few natural privileges in a town of the prairie. The difference between watching the sun set over cornfields or over water. It was a graceful, good-sized lake. Back in high school, at night, he had driven around and around it with Sally Kramer, wondering if she'd want to pull into the shelter of Sunset Park. Or other times with his friends talking about urgent matters, worrying about the existence of God and theories of causation. Then there had not been a war. But there had always been the lake, which was the town's first cause of existence, a place for immigrant settlers to put down their loads. Before the settlers were the Sioux, and before the Sioux were the vast open prairies, and before the prairies there was only ice. The lake bed had been dug out by the southernmost advance of the Wisconsin Glacier. Fed by neither streams nor springs, the lake was often filthy and algaed, relying on fickle prairie rains for replenishment. Still, it was the only important body of water within 40 miles, a source of pride, nice to look at on bright summer days, and later that evening it would color up with fireworks. Now, in the late afternoon, it lay calm and smooth, a good audience for silence, a 7-mile circumference that could be traveled by slow car in 25 minutes. It was not such a good lake for swimming. After high school, he'd caught an ear infection that almost kept him out of the war. And the lake had drowned his friend, Max Arnold, keeping him out of the war entirely. Max had been one who liked to talk about the existence of God. "No, I'm not saying that," he'd argue against the drone of the engine. "I'm saying it's possible as an idea, even necessary as an idea, a final cause in the whole structure of causation." Now he knew, perhaps. Before the war, they'd driven around the lake as friends. But now Max was just an idea, and most of Norman Bowker's other friends were living in Des Moines or Sioux City, or going to school somewhere, or holding down jobs. The high school girls were mostly gone or married. Sally Kramer, whose pictures he had once carried in his wallet, was one who had married. Her name was now Sally Gustafson, and she lived in a pleasant blue house on the less expensive side of the lake road. On his third day home, he'd seen her out mowing the lawn, still pretty, in a lacy red blouse and white shorts. For a moment, he'd almost pulled over, just to talk. But instead, he pushed down hard on the gas pedal. She looked happy. She had her house and her new husband, and there was really nothing he could say to her. The town seemed remote somehow. Sally was married and Max was drowned, and his father was at home watching baseball on national TV. Norman Bowker shrugged. "No problem," he murmured. Clockwise, as if in orbit, he took the Chevy on another 7-mile turn around the lake. Even in late afternoon, the day was hot. He turned on the air conditioner, then the radio, and he leaned back and let the cold air and music blow over him. Along the road, kicking stones in front of them, two young boys were hiking with knapsacks and toy rifles and canteens. He honked going by, but neither boy looked up. Already he had passed them, 6 times, 42 miles, nearly 3 hours without stop. He watched the boys recede in his rearview mirror. They turned a soft brownish color, like sand, before finally disappearing. He tapped down lightly on the accelerator. Out on the lake, a man's motorboat had stalled. The man was bent over the engine with a wrench and a frown. Beyond the stalled boat, there were other boats, and a few water skiers, and the smooth July waters, and an immense flatness everywhere. 2 mud hens floated stiffly beside a white dock. The road curved west, where the sun had now dipped low. He figured it was close to 5 o'clock, 20 after, he guessed. The war had taught him to tell time without clocks, and even at night, waking from sleep, he could usually place it within 10 minutes either way. What he should do, he thought, is stop at Sally's house and impress her with this new time-telling trick of his. They'd talk for a while, catching up on things, and then he'd say, "Well, better hit the road, it's 5:34," and she'd glance at her wristwatch and say, "Hey, how'd you do that?" And he'd give a casual shrug and tell her it was just one of those things you pick up. He'd keep it light. He wouldn't say anything about anything. "How's it being married?" he might ask, and he'd nod at whatever she answered with. And he would not say a word about how he almost won the Silver Star for valor. He drove past Slater Park and across the causeway and past Sunset Park. The radio announcer sounded tired. The temperature in Des Moines was 81 degrees, and the time was 5:35. "And all of you on the road, drive extra careful now on this fine 4th of July." If Sally had not been married or his father were not such a baseball fan, it would have been a good time to talk.
"Silver Star?" his father might have said.
"Yes, but I didn't get it. Almost, but
not quite. And his father would have nodded, knowing full well that many brave men do not win medals for their bravery, and that others win medals for doing nothing. As a starting point, maybe, Norman Bowker might then have listed the 7 medals he did win. The Combat Infantryman's Badge, the Air Medal, the Army Commendation Medal, the Good Conduct Medal, the Vietnam Campaign Medal, the Bronze Star, and the Purple Heart. Though his wound was minor and did not leave a scar, and did not hurt and never had. He would have explained to his father that none of these decorations were for uncommon valor. They were for common valor. The routine daily stuff, just humping, just enduring. But that was worth something, wasn't it? Yes, it was. Worth plenty. The ribbons looked good on the uniform in his closet, and if his father were to ask, he would have explained what each signified, and how he was proud of all of them, especially the Combat Infantryman's Badge, because it meant he had been there, as a real soldier, and had done all the things soldiers do, and therefore it wasn't such a big deal that he couldn't bring himself to be uncommonly brave. And then he would have talked about the medal he did not win, and why he did not win it. "I almost won the Silver Star," he would have said. "How's that?" "Just a story."
"So, tell me," his father would have said.
Slowly then, circling the lake, Norman Bowker would have started by describing the Song Tra Bong. "A river," he would have said. "This slow, flat, muddy river." He would have explained how during the dry season it was exactly like any other river. Nothing special. But how in October the monsoons began and the whole situation changed. For a solid week the rains never stopped. Not once. And so after a few days the Song Tra Bong overflowed its banks, and the land turned into a deep, thick muck for a quarter mile on either side. Just muck. No other word for it. Like quicksand, almost, except the stink was incredible. "You couldn't even sleep," he'd tell his father. "At night you'd find a high spot and you'd doze off, but then later you'd wake up because you'd be buried in all that slime. You'd just sink in. You'd feel it ooze up over your body and sort of suck you down. And the whole time there was that constant rain. I mean, it never stopped. Not ever."
"Sounds pretty wet," his father would have said, pausing briefly. "So, what happened?"
"You really want to hear this?"
"Hey, I'm your father."
Norman Bowker smiled. He looked out across the lake and imagined the feel of his tongue against the truth. "Well, this one time... this one night out by the river, I wasn't very brave."
"You have 7 medals."
"Sure."
7, count 'em. You weren't a coward either."
"Well, maybe not, but I had the chance, and I blew it. The stink, that's what got to me. I couldn't take that goddamn awful smell."
"If you don't want to say more."
"I do want to."
"All right, then. Slow and sweet. Take your time."
The road descended into the outskirts of town, turning northwest past the junior college and the tennis courts, then past Chautauqua Park, where picnic tables were spread with sheets of colored plastic, and where picnickers sat on lawn chairs and listened to the high school band playing Sousa marches under the bandshell. The music faded after a few blocks. He drove beneath a canopy of elms, then along a stretch of open shore, then past the municipal docks, where a woman in petal pushers stood casting for bullheads. There were no other fish in the lake except for perch and a few worthless carp. It was a bad lake for swimming and fishing, both. He drove slowly. No hurry, nowhere to go. Inside the Chevy, the air was cool and oily-smelling, and he took pleasure in the steady sounds of the engine and air conditioning. A tour bus feeling, in a way, except the town he was touring seemed dead. Through the windows, as if in a stop-motion photograph, the place looked as if it had been hit by nerve gas. Everything still and lifeless, even the people. The town could not talk and would not listen. "How do you like to hear about the war?" he might have asked. But the place could only blink and shrug. It had no memory, therefore no guilt. The taxes got paid, the votes got counted, and the agencies of government did their work briskly and politely. It was a brisk, polite town. It did not know shit about shit,
and did not care to know. Norman Bowker leaned back and considered what he might have said on the subject.